Well, turn back if you would to Esther chapter 2, as we're going to carry on that series we began a week or two ago. We gave it sort of the title of the whole series, the Drama of Esther. Looking at this book is quite an unusual book of the Bible. And the way it doesn't just tell us the bare facts of the history, like you'd find in Kings or Chronicles or somewhere like that, but tells it us in a very different way, in quite a dramatic way that's trying to stir our emotions as well. And so we began thinking about that last week. Chapter 1, or perhaps Act 1 if you're keeping it as a drama, would be setting the scene. And we looked at that last week, that we were set the scene of Chapter 1 in the land of Persia. And we were introduced to one of the key actors, Ahasuerus. And this week it carries on then in Chapter 2 in establishing both that character of Ahasuerus and a couple of other characters will be introduced as well. Last time we were introduced to an empire and an emperor. And we said in chapter 1, the things that it described, the way that the writer goes into so much detail of this banquet and the palace and the gardens and all the things that are described in it. It is one of those things that's meant to leave us with our jaws dropped down as we are just astonished by, it's one of these sort of one of these marvels of the ancient world, like one of those sort of things that we just lost. What are these amazing extravagance there in one of these greatest empires that there ever was. But at the same time, disgusted by it, disgusted by its pretentiousness, by its pride and arrogance, by this extravagance and total over-the-topness about it all. And its overindulgence. And we said, actually, the chapter 1 especially seems to be full of sarcasm sometimes as it describes these things a little bit tongue-in-cheek about these daft laws that they keep making. And then, principally, in this character, Ahasuerus, this powerful man, the most powerful man in the world at that time, the man who has it all except the respect of his own wife. And the man who can command anything, can say anything, but he has no idea what to say to his wife. When he, in a drunken stupor, makes demands of his wife and she dares to say no. And the whole kingdom falls apart, because he's no idea what to do next. Well, we're told in chapter 2 and verse 1, after these things, after the things of chapter 1 have happened, but actually a couple of years have gone past. Well, especially by the time you get to chapter 2 and verse 16. And we read that Esther is taken to King Ahasuerus in the 7th year of his reign. Back in chapter 1 verse 3, we were only in the 3rd year of his reign. So some years have gone past since that. If you wanted a little bit of a recap of the history, that's what we looked at a little bit at another time. So this is all happening after the fall of Jerusalem. Over there in the red, that happened to the empire of the Babylonians, famously King Nebuchadnezzar. Those sort of things are given to us in 2 Chronicles and Kings, the prophets of Jeremiah and the like. After Nebuchadnezzar came Belshazzar, and there were those who lived through those periods, like Ezekiel and Daniel. And then the Babylonians fell to the Medes and Persians. Cyrus was the first king of that, and he was the one who allowed the Israelites to go back home to Jerusalem. That's given to us in the first half of the book of Ezra. And then after him came Darius, some of the prophets like Haggai and Zechariah. And then comes this king with his three names, Ahasuerus or Xerxes or Artaxerxes the first. And it doesn't matter which name you go for, really. And that's the king who's the king in the book of Esther. And then after him comes Artaxerxes the second. And then there's another return from exile, and Ezra in his book, Nehemiah in his book, and some of the last prophets like Malachi. And our little bits, we're dealing with just an act. So we think in about 483, Vashti was removed as queen. 479, Esther is appointed queen in chapter 2, where we are now. And in between, he loses the Battle of Salamis, which isn't mentioned at all in the Bible, but you'll find a lot of references to it in other history books. Which might account for the fact why King Ahasuerus is in such a bad mood. It may not just be he remembered Vashti and what she did, but he'd just been thoroughly humiliated by the Greeks. He had taken a massive army to try and conquer Greece, and it had gone from bad to worse. He'd been defeated one time after another, and there was this naval battle off the island of Salamis, where his vast navy, one of the biggest navies there had ever been at that point, of probably about 1,000 ships, was utterly defeated by a group of 200 ships commanded by the Greeks. And from then on, the empires are changing. The Persian Empire is on its decline. After failing to conquer Greece, Greece is rising and they are going down. And so that may be why King Ahasuerus is in an even worse mood. And so we're introduced here in chapter 2 to the competition. What to do to cheer up an emperor? An emperor who's lost some major battles, whose empire is on the wane, and who has no queen. And this is the question that the king's servants are contemplating. And they have three words that they think will sort it out in verse 2. Beautiful, young, virgins. That's what to do when your empire is falling apart and the king is grumpy. Beautiful, young, virgins. That's what we need to find. That will sort out this situation. And so in the verses that follow, all over the empire, a competition is going to begin. And it seems that there was anyone could apply for it, as long as you came into that qualification, being beautiful, young, and a virgin. You could apply for that, to enter into this competition, to be the next queen, we're told. That's the whole point of it. Verse 4, that the young woman who pleases the king, who wins the competition, to be queen instead of Vashti. And in it, there's no hint here in the chapter that this is at all forced, but that those are willing volunteers who come to participate in it, in the ancient X Factor competition. And who wouldn't want to be the most important woman in the world? The first lady. To be married to King Ahasuerus would make you the most important woman in the world. To have the ear of the king. And so it seems that there's no shortage of volunteers to go and enter into this competition. And who wouldn't? Who wouldn't dream of being? You know, girls love to, even the young toddlers at tops, they love to put on a little princess dress and a crown. Who wouldn't want to be a princess? Who wouldn't want to be a queen? Everyone seeks after those sorts of things. It makes perfect sense in the world's eyes. If you want to be powerful, if you want to have money, if you want to have influence, if you want to have everything this world offers, then you enter this competition, don't you? And the king, I guess, has the prerogative to do it. The king has the prerogative to try and find the most beautiful bride in all the kingdom to be his bride. I say there's no shortage, it seems, of eager volunteers who want to enter. But I say in this chapter, there's sort of overtones of other things happening. So it's not just a competition, but it's a disgraceful one. A disgraceful competition. I think people are entering into it willingly, but notice the phrase that's given to it in verse 3. Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of all his kingdom. That's a bit like chapter 1, a typical sort of over the top. You need a vast branch of the civil service to sort out this now. And they carry on. Let they may gather all the beautiful young women to Shushan the citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women. They're going from the kingdom, coming there to the capital, Shushan. And then what are they? Under custody. They're under custody there, aren't they? They are being confined into the women's quarters. They have now become the property of a king. Isn't it? That's what's happening here. They're no longer free. They may enter willingly, but they can't ever leave again. They have now become his property. Carry on in verse 3. And then let beauty preparations be given to them. More of that is mentioned several times. Verse 9. A certain young woman, will come to her later, and she obtained his favour, and she was given extra beauty preparations, apart from her allowance as well. And then it carries on in verse 12. of what was happening for each of the women, and that they were given these 12 months of preparation. 12 months. They were going to be given these beauty preparations in the confines of the women's quarters, kept under the custody of the king's eunuch. And the days of their preparation were like this: 6 months with oil and myrrh, and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for the beautifying of women. They're being turned into Barbie dolls. What's happening there in those verses? It's the cosmetic surgery of their day. They're being bathed in oil for 6 months. I don't think that necessarily means they're in a vat of oil constantly for 6 months, but that's what they're meant to be doing every day, as it were, being dipped, being bathed in oil. Myrrh, especially applied liberally for 6 months, would bleach your skin. In white culture, people like to have fake tans, don't they? I bet they go there for spray on tans and the like. But in their culture, it was the opposite. To be pale was the in thing, and so to be smothered in myrrh all the time would bleach your skin. Actually, probably make you look a bit white, like a ghost, really, after 6 months of it. But maybe that was the king's thing. Who knows? But that's what was happening. That was what was decreed for 6 months. 6 months of perfumes, spices. Some people suggested that they may have been fumigated in these things, in some sort of bizarre tent, presumably not over their heads, so they couldn't breathe. But then incense and spices are being sort of burnt underneath that into some sort of tent around the woman's body. And after being in oil for so long, the skin would be so soft that these spices would just sort of absorb, a little bit like basting a turkey for Christmas. And all these spices and flavours are going into her skin. Weird, you know, weird sort of stuff, isn't it? But it is. It's disgraceful, isn't it? You know, they're sort of thinking, God, what? For 12 months? 6 months of this? 6 months of that? Kept confined for all of that time? The women who went into this process would have been barely recognisable coming out the other end after 12 months of this kind of treatment. They were completely changed, like Barbie dolls, into objects of the king's lust. And what was the whole point of it? The whole point of it was, it was a sex competition. It was a sex competition. That was it. It was this 12-month preparation was for one night with the king in the king's bedroom. Verse 12, each young woman came to go to King Ahasuerus after she'd done this 12 months. Verse 13, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take from the women's quarters to go to the king's palace. In the evening she went, in the morning she returned. But didn't return to the same place, notice that. She returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of another man, Shazgaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. So this 12 months preparation was ready for a one-night stand with the king. And then after that, she left in the morning to go to another house, the second house, of the king's concubines. There to remain for the rest of her life, unless the king ever asked. This was the competition they were entering into. Never to see the king again, never to go and leave that house again, unless the king asked her again. Whoever provided the most pleasure for the king would get the job of being the queen. And we're meant to read these things with disgust, aren't we? And think, what a corrupt world. What a corrupt world it is where such things go on. And it's not illegal. It's taking place here. It's perfectly above board. Every one knows exactly what's happening in the country. There's this powerful man who can do whatever he likes. And there are those who are willing to get involved in it for what they think they might get out of it. But of course, the vast majority of them got nothing for it, did they? And yet, it doesn't take a genius, does it? It doesn't take an awful lot of reading the newspapers to find an awful lot of modern equivalents to this, do we? Last year, when all the scandal of Harvey Weinstein came out, this powerful media mogul in the States, producer of films and the like, and with his power and influence and money, could sleep with whichever actress he liked, and in return he might give them a good role in his next movie and the like. Isn't it just the same as Athazur is? And everyone, when the story hit the headlines, came out in condemning such behaviour. But Hollywood had known it was going on for decades. And he wasn't the only one. It's the kind of thing that goes on. People worship, as some people have said, an unholy trinity of money, sex, and power. That's what the world is after. And yet, whatever a couple of those you may have, you can try and get the other. You can try and demand what you like. Everyone wants it. These willing volunteers are trying to get the money and the power and the influence in the kingdom. These people are applying for the competition. The king's abusing his power and authority. All the other servants beneath him playing their roles in it. It's disgraceful, isn't it? We read these things and we're filled with a sense of loathing to be part of a world that operates like this. Well, secondly, there was the choice. The choice. I say in this chapter we're introduced to the next couple of key characters for us to consider. Mordecai and Esther. And what are we to make of these two? We're filled with unanswered questions, aren't we? The things we read about Mordecai and Esther here, they are Jews. They're still living here in Babylon, and they're living in the capital, Shushan, the capital of Persia. And what are we to make of them? It's a little bit like a film. It's a drama here. We're introduced to these characters, Esther and Mordecai, and they're going to be the ones in some of the center stage for the rest of this drama. And yet they just drop there on the scene. They just appear from behind the curtain. They just start playing their parts. And we're left scratching our heads thinking, are they goodies or baddies? What are we to make of them? Like the way you're introduced to a character in a film or in the theatre, and you don't know everything about them to start with. You're just introduced to a character and you don't really know what to make of them. It's a little bit like that here with these two, isn't it? Mordecai, this man. And it's introduced to us in a very loving way. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that was her Jewish name, but Esther is a more well-known name, a Persian name. And it was his uncle's daughter. For she had neither father or mother, or it says later on that her father and mother died. And Mordecai took her as his own daughter. In the Jewish community, a fairly common thing. Extended family was very close-knit, and so on. They might live next door to each other all the time anyway, in that sort of society, and the father and mother died, we don't know why or how. And Mordecai takes her in under his own roof and cares for her and raises her as his own daughter. It's referred to right at the end that and Esther obeyed Mordecai in verse 20, just like she'd always had done while she was being brought up by him. The language is very loving language. Of that he is this man, Mordecai, who cares for this little orphan cousin, niece of his, exactly, not quite sure exactly how to phrase that sometimes, but and then he cares for her. But what motivates them to get involved in this competition? We don't know. What is it that motivates them? Did Esther volunteer? Was it her idea? Was it Mordecai's plan? Even if you sort of take away, well, perhaps they were under sort of compulsion to do it, it was very easy to get out of it. You had to be a beautiful young virgin. All Mordecai had to do was arrange a marriage, which was the done thing in the Jewish culture, even there in captivity. All he had to do was arrange for her to be married to a nice Jewish boy. That kind of thing happened very quickly in their culture, not months and months of planning. And she would be taken off the market for the king. Why do they do it? Why do they get involved in this? Perhaps, we've no idea, we're just grasping at straws. Perhaps there was an appeal to it. Perhaps it was seeking after the power, the influence of that. Maybe it was a desire to be queen. Maybe it was the riches and the extravagance that would come their way. Who knows, maybe they had good motivations behind it. Perhaps they thought, if only we could get a Jew into that country, kind of position of power where she could have the king's ear. Wouldn't that be good for God's people? Maybe. Maybe they had good ideas behind it. But this was their plan. We're just guessing. What motivated them to get involved in those things? Well, they made their choice. But it was a dangerous choice they made. They may have had good ideas, good things that they were trying to achieve, but it was a dangerous choice they made. Esther, as we've noticed before, was taken away from her adopted family. All of these women go from their homes, their families, they go into the custody of this eunuch. They're taken away. And she was going to be the plaything of a king in the hope of being the one who was chosen to be queen. And at what cost? Did Mordecai, even if they thought they had good reasons for starting this off, did they think about the cost? The cost of what would happen? As Esther would be isolated from her adoptive family, isolated from God's people, never able to publicly pray with the Jews, never able to meet together on a Sabbath day, never able to meet for the festivals and the like, disobeying God's law. And so they went into it. There, even if she succeeded, or even in the year that was the build-up of it, even as one of the king's concubines, or even as the queen, whatever was going to happen, wouldn't there have to be some involvement in pagan worship? Wouldn't there have to be some involvement in visiting their temples, bowing down to their idols and the like? Wouldn't they have to disobey God's dietary laws? What even if she had children with the king? How are those children going to be raised? As those who knew the true God, or those that worshipped the idols of the Persians? Did they ever think about the costs? Did they ever think about how dangerous it was that they were trying to do? And yet that's the way it comes across here in this chapter, isn't it? In verse 11, Esther is locked away for a year with her preparations. Verse 11, and every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Every day Mordecai paced up and down like a worried adoptive father for his daughter. He couldn't see, doing anything to hear news. Was he there at the back door, asking the cook and the cleaner as they came out, any news of Esther? How's she doing? Had he thought beforehand of the cost of the choices they were making? Do we think about that? Do we think about the costs? There's lots of things available to us in the world, isn't there? All sorts of things can come our way. Not necessarily bad things. So there's a lot of hints that this was a very bad thing that they were entering into. But all sorts of other things. We might say they're quite neutral. You know, getting a promotion, it could be great. But do we sometimes think, well, what could be the disadvantages to that? What could be the cost to that? Yeah, I'd have more money. I might have more influence in the business or whatever it was where we're working. But what could there be a cost? Could that mean more hours? Work? Could that mean trickier situations? Could that mean more stress? What kind of impact was that going to have on my family? What kind of impact is that going to have? Do we think about the costs of those things? Do we think of what it might mean? It's hard to always guess, but do we try and enter into those things with our eyes open, prayerfully considering whether this is the right or wrong thing for us? Thirdly, there's the compromise. The compromise. Here's this funny book of the Bible, the Book of Esther. This dramatic book. Also the only book in the Bible that never mentions the name of God. That's peculiar, isn't it? There's no mention of God in this book. And I guess a lot of the fault of that must fall to Mordecai and Esther, mustn't it? Because Mordecai and Esther, these key characters amongst God's people, they never use his name in any of their speeches that they give? Does the fault fall to them? It's a compromise, you see, through and through in this book. And we're introduced to Mordecai, this rather ambiguous character, back in verse 5. In Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. And right from the start, that raises a few eyebrows if you knew your Jewish history. He descends from Benjamin. That was the tribe that their father Jacob said he's the ravenous wolf. You never know what you're going to get with Benjamin. And through the stories of Benjamin, through the books of Judges and the like. Benjamin? It's this tricky tribe. Sometimes it's there right at the front. Sometimes it's right at the back, doing all sorts of unspeakable things. Benjamin's the tribe that's almost obliterated in a civil war because of their immorality. The tribe has its up and downs. It's a precarious tribe. It's a dangerous tribe in some ways. And he relates Mordecai to two of his famous distant relatives, Shimei. Shimei was a Benjamite who verbally abused David. When David was going through one of his greatest trials, Shimei was the one to hurl abuse and refuse at him. He's also given to us as the son of Kish, and that's the father of King Saul. And King Saul himself, that character with ups and downs, isn't it? The character of Saul who saved the kingdom from the Philistines. David would say of him in his funeral eulogy that Saul was the most beautiful in Jerusalem, the beautiful one of the kingdom, the one who saved the nation, and yet the one who before his death was consulting the dead and disobeying God. And Mordecai is introduced in that kind of line. And the writer of Esther just gives us these couple of little snippets from his history. So we're already thinking, what are we to make of this guy? What are we to make of him? And some of it is say, so he comes from this rather dubious, rather ups and downs family. He, of course, is the child of exile. Verse 6. How many more times can you say the word exile in a sentence? So Mordecai, who had been exiled away from Jerusalem with the exiles, who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. He's the child of exile. Same word every time through that sentence, drumming it into us. This is a mess that he's born in. A mess of not of his own making is unlikely he himself was exiled. More likely his parents, otherwise he'd be over 100 at this kind of time. And it's that situation. He's born in it. He belongs to generations of disobedience. And there he is now in exile. And he's still there. 50 years before, the people living in exile had the option to return. Mordecai's family didn't. Again, unlikely to be Mordecai making that decision. He was probably a child at that time, at a guess. But his parents made the decision not to go back to Jerusalem. Most of them didn't. There was about 1 million Jews in captivity. About 40,000 of them returned. Why didn't Mordecai? Why didn't his parents? Why didn't they go back with God's people to re-establish God's kingdom with God's temple and the worship of the true God there? They didn't. It's hard to say. Hard to say, isn't it? There were those who'd risen to positions of some influence. There were those who were very accommodating of what went on in the empire. There was sometimes a risk more of persecution if you went back to Israel. Many had grown rich and comfortable. There they were. We'd read of Mordecai that he's somebody who lives by the gate. Again, a little bit ambiguous. Verse 21, he's one who sits by the king's gate as one of the king's servants. So he could well have some minor role in the palace already as a gatekeeper or something like that. It's a compromise. But it's a disastrous one. It may be partly the compromises of his parents and his parents before that and the like. And Mordecai follows suit in making one compromise after another. And there's such a contrast between this book and the book of Daniel. Very similar times. We had them before on the timeline. A very similar time, just Daniel a little bit earlier, but no easier. in the situation. But people say, dare to be a Daniel. No one ever says, dare to be a Mordecai. Because he didn't dare. He wasn't that kind of person. He didn't dare, he compromised. Esther 2. And there's so many contrasts in the book between those two. In verse 10, Mordecai is told, tells Esther not to reveal her people or family. And it's drummed into us again at the end, in verse 20. That again, Esther won't tell people about her God, her people, her family. Keep it secret. Hide your ado. Did Mordecai and Esther love God? I don't know. They never say so. They never even mention it. But maybe they do, deep down. But they have this idea that they're going to keep it all completely hidden. Never tell a soul anything to do with the true God and the people they come from. They make one dangerous compromise after another. How do they compare to Daniel and his friends? Daniel took a stand on food. Esther doesn't. She can't. Well, that would give away the people she comes from. She has to go along with it. She goes into this situation for 12 months. She has to eat just what everyone else eats. Daniel, or rather his three friends, made a stand on not worshipping that huge idol of Nebuchadnezzar's. But Esther doesn't. Esther can't. She's one of the king's harem. When they all go down to the temple, they've all got to bow. Esther's got to go along with it, or she'd be caught out. She'd give the game away. Daniel makes a stand on prayer. He prays to the true gods. He prays to the living gods. Esther can't. She can't be seen bowing down, praying towards Jerusalem, can she? He'd give the game away. She's got to make one more compromise after another. I think Mordecai does love Esther. He's there pacing away around in front of the courts. Did he bring her up well? Did he teach her to fear the Lord? But then he gives her away. He gives her away. He gives her into the custody of Haggai. It's told us twice in verse 8 to sort of drum it into us. She's no longer Mordecai's daughter. She's now under the custody of Haggai. He gives her away. And she gives her virginity in a one-night stand to a sleazy king. She's an impressionable girl, it comes across in verse 9. Under the custody of Haggai, the young woman Esther pleased him, and she obtained his favour. She's teacher's pet. She's impressionable. She does everything she can to win the favour of Haggai. Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is to teach them for a year everything they need to know to enter into the sex competition for a king. And she goes along with it all. What a mess. What a disastrous compromise. And yet, is there an application for us? Do we have to be careful in the compromises we make? And one thing that can lead to another? So easily we can do the same? Keep our faith hidden. Don't want to tell anyone. Don't want to give the game away. We fear the consequences. We fear we might get a bit of stick for that sort of thing. So we keep it quiet. And one thing leads to another. We've got to go along with this. We've got to go along with that. And the like. Can there be applications for those of us who are raising children at the moment? Can sometimes we get confused with our priorities? And we might think, we want our children to achieve well academically. And sure, there's good in that. And we want our children to have lots of extracurricular activities. But do we think about what that might compromise along the way? And what they might miss out on in those things? And as they grow up, as they become young adults, and we encourage them to pursue their career, try and climb their profession. Are we those who are giving our children away to other things? Into situations where they're no longer under the loving influence of our father and mother and the like. In this. Maybe you say they might, if we give them the benefit of the doubt, they might have started off with good motives. We thought of a few of those already that they might possibly have had. But it all could have been for nothing, couldn't it? Sometimes Christians do that. sometimes Christians say, well, what I'll do is I'll just knuckle down. I'm just going to get, if I can get to the top of my profession, then I can have an influence for God. But on the way up, I'll keep it quiet. I won't tell anyone about it now. I'll work night and day. I'll work Sundays too. And then one day I'll be really able to do something for good, for God. There. But whether the compromises on the way have made it, by the time you do get to that top, to that dream, that hope, maybe that good ambition you had is long forgotten. It could have been for nothing. Esther could easily have just been one of the many discarded playthings of a king. And it all could have been a disastrous compromise that had no positive outcome at all. Lastly then, just to finish off the conclusion. Esther wins. How could she not? We're told so many times through this chapter she's beautiful. We're told in chapter verse 7, told it in verse 15. Everyone knows that Esther's beautiful. And there's the conclusion for it. Esther wins. End of verse 17, she becomes queen. Verse 18, she even has her own feast declared after her. But is it a hollow victory? Is it all they ever dreamed of? And the end of our chapter is rather a dubious conclusion, isn't it? Even after this cost, even after this compromise, read his rather sleazy declaration of love in verse 17. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favour in his sight more than all the other virgins. So he put his crown on her. That's what she wins. The sleazy declaration of a king. Of all the women I love and have slept with, Esther, you're the one I love the most. That's hardly a great line, is it? That's hardly real love, is it, that she's given? And then she becomes the number one lady. She's given the crown, we're told, of Vashti. Had to bring her name up again. Verse 17, that's rather a poison chalice she's getting, isn't it? It's like being the next queen of Henry VIII. She's now in the position of Vashti. And one wrong move, and that'll be it. It's a bit of a hollow victory, isn't it? And the story moves on. Verse 19 carries on for us. That sometime later, verse 19, when virgins were gathered a second time, the king's just back up to his old tricks. He's no better. Does he love Esther? No. When we're introduced to Esther later on, she says she hasn't even seen the king for a couple of months. It's a hollow victory. The king's still sleeping with other women. Mordecai is still at the gate. Maybe he was hoping for a promotion himself, but he's still there at the gate. Even when Mordecai discovers and thwarts an assassination attempt in those last couple of verses, nothing. Not even a Christmas bonus. He gets nothing for it. Any influence they were hoping for, it isn't there. It's a dubious conclusion, isn't it? At the end of this. What are we to make of a chapter like this? this dramatic chapter. And there's so much in it. And I've taken a little bit too long than I should have done. But just in conclusion, what the world offers is so fleeting, isn't it? Here's this, what the world has on offer. And yet it's nothing. This disgusting competition, this dangerous choice they make, their disastrous compromise, the dubious conclusion. It promises so much and gives so little. And Esther's meant to involve us emotionally. This chapter's a little bit like reading the Daily Mail. You know, one of those exposés of some scandalous behaviour that's going on. And you read it and think, oh, what a mess. What a tragedy. Why could no one stand up for what was good in that situation? And you read it and read through this article or whatever. And everyone comes out of it smeared and dirty from it. That's the chapter, isn't it? It's what the world's like. It's just a mess. But lastly, there's a little bit of good news. Because God's still in control. God is still in control. I'm trying not to give away the end of the story. You know the end of the story. But here in the chapter, it's just a mess. But if you know anything that's going to happen later, then that's our confidence, isn't it? And isn't that a wonderful thing, that God can use our mistakes, God can use our poor choices, our grubby little compromises. God can use them for his good. That doesn't make it right. That doesn't mean we should be careless or we should downplay things. But the wonderful thing in this book is that God can use the mess. The mess in an empire. The mess even of the professing people of God. Mordecai and Esther. These people who are meant to love God, who never mention him. And who go through these mistakes one after another. But what a sign of God's grace. God is going to use this first-class mess for good. Isn't that amazing? And shouldn't that give us hope? Because perhaps this morning, as we think of these dubious choices, as we think of these disastrous compromises of Mordecai and Esther, perhaps our minds are made to think of some of our own. Some of our own things that we've done. Paths we headed down and there was no way out. And perhaps we're still in them today. And we wish we could turn back the clock, turn back 10, 20 years, however many it might be, and put that right, but we can't. We headed down that path, we did make a mistake. It was the wrong thing to do, but it's too late to go back. Isn't it a wonderful thing that God can use the mess for his good? So it's not to encourage us to be careless in our decision making, but to encourage us nevertheless that even when we look back with mistakes, with regret over our mistakes, to know that God is in control. Isn't that something we see at Christmas? Before the birth of Jesus, isn't it a right mess? There's no prophets. There's no one who's really looking for the coming of the Messiah. The nation's a mess. Israel's invaded. The Romans are there. Everything is a mess. But God's got all the pieces just where he wants them to send his son. And so it is so many times in history. And so it is in our own lives. Our gracious God can use our mess for his glory. Let's close and sing our last hymn as we ask for God's wisdom to try not to make such a mess, to try and be those who follow him and walk in his ways, unlike Esther and Mordecai. Let's sing our last hymn prayerfully, number 807, Teach Me Your Way, O Lord. Teach me your way. That's all we need, isn't it? To walk through this messy world with all of its difficult choices that need to be made. Let's ask for God's wisdom as we sing together our last hymn.